Just a quick word from our sponsor, Freed. Think about the last time you finished your clinic day or a day in the hospital without a backlog of notes waiting for you. With Freed, that can be your everyday reality. It's not just an AI tool. It's your personal time saver that instantly transcribes and preps a full medical document for you to review. And the backstory of Freed was that it was actually crafted by a computer engineer who watched his physician wife lose her nights and weekends to charting. His solution? An AI that integrates seamlessly into your workflow, understands your needs over time, and most importantly, frees up that precious time. And it's fully HIPAA compliant. With Freed, documentation no longer has to feel like a big lift with a lot of inertia energy. Give it a try and see if it works for your workflow. You get 10 notes for free with Freed. Most people say it saves them 2 hours a day. And after those 10 free notes, it's just $99 a month. It's a small price for a peace of mind and the return of your nighttime and your weekends with your loved ones. As a bonus, CoreAM listeners get 50% off the first month by using the code CORE50. Again, use the code CORE50 to get 50% off your first month with Freed. Welcome to Beyond Journal Club, a collaboration between CoreAM and NEJM Group.
The goal of Beyond Journal Club is to take landmark clinical trials and put them into context. We're telling the story about how we got to where we are, what it means for our patients, and how we take care.
I'm Dr. Shori Trifetti, an internist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Greg Katz, cardiologist at NYU.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Gorey, an editorial fellow at the New England Journal of Medicine.
And this may be the first time we have a friend from overseas and from the wonderful great land of Ireland.
Well, I'm really honored to be the first and hopefully not the last.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome. I feel way more sophisticated when I talk to you, and I probably is a psychological thing, but I'm excited.
Okay, so today we are talking about the REVISE trial, which was published in the July 4th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine in 2024.
All right, and so put it out there. What did the REVISE trial ask?
REVISE asked the question, do proton pump inhibitors, aka PPIs, prevent stress ulcers? And do they do that without causing harm in intubated ICU patients?
My first thought when I was considering this trial was how many of us just get a prompt that we should be ordering stress ulcer prophylaxis, and then we click sign in the EMR. And it makes me cynical to see how sometimes the evidence behind our most common practices isn't always all that strong. And so I think REVISE is really interesting because it helps us dive into whether PPI prophylaxis is like too many other things that we do in medicine, built on a house of cards worth of flimsy evidence.
Yeah. Oh, I love that imagery. I feel like that cover art of like flimsy cards is should be like the cover art of The House of God or many of the books written about medicine in general.
I didn't know you had a cynical bone in your body. So that's interesting to see.
Sometimes I am a real Eeyore. But anyways, let's go back to the more positive side of things. Sarah, what are we covering today?
So before we dive into the story behind this trial, let's just review exactly what a stress ulcer is and make sure we're totally clear about what type of patients are at risk.
Yeah, and then we're going to discuss the story of acid blockade and what the evidence has actually showed in terms of PPIs in the first place.
And finally, we'll discuss how the REVISE trial can impact our patient care, particularly with deprescribing, even if we're not intensivists or rotating through an ICU. I have to start with a confession here. I'm not sure that I really know what a stress ulcer is. I really thought that gastric ulcers were caused by H. pylori or too many NSAIDs, not stress.
Well, don't stress, Greg. The difference is really simple. Stress ulcers can develop in the GI tract during a critical illness.
Yeah, and I was surprised to learn how common those stress ulcers in the critically ill actually can be. So if you go down to your local ICU and do a scope on all your ventilated patients, you'll find some level of mucosal erosion in around 75% of them.
Yeah, but just because there's mucosal erosion, it doesn't mean someone is definitely going to bleed. So we should stress. How many times do you think I can make that joke,
Sarah?
Quite a few more.
Anyway, so the point is, bleeding from stress ulcers can be a wide spectrum from barely detectable occult bleeding to massive GI hemorrhage.
Okay, then Sarah, what did we learn then when it comes to the past studies on stress ulcers?
Well, I nearly did get a stress ulcer from reading all of these studies because the stress ulcer studies and GI bleeds, they were kind of like the Wild West. They had all these different definitions for bleeding events.
Ah, and that makes it probably really hard to then define the problem, right? If we're not on the same page of what exactly we're talking about, we can't really find effective solutions.
Exactly. So it took until the 1990s when the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group, which incidentally is the team behind the revised trial, they defined the term clinically important bleeding to mean overt bleeding from stress ulcers that was associated with either, number one, hemodynamic compromise.
Hemodynamic compromise meaning a drop of 20 millimeters of mercury in blood pressure or a rise of 20 beats per minute in heart rate.
Yeah, or two, a drop in hemoglobin of more than 2 grams per deciliter or the need for a transfusion of two or more units of blood.
And so they found clinically important bleeding, remember, the ones that led to hemodynamic instability or transfusion, in critically ill patients occurred about 1.5% of the time. So it's nowhere near as common as you might think that it is.
Yeah, and even though that clinically important bleed is rare, we should point out that the mortality rate from clinically important bleeding can be as high as 50%. So these bleeds are a real big deal for that small group of patients that do develop them.
Wow, that's pretty high. And so the Canadian Critical Care Trials Group, I like what they did in the 1990s. They suggested a risk-benefit ratio for individual patients. They proposed that stress ulcer prophylaxis be given to those at the highest risk.
Okay, so it sounds like they were ahead of the curve in personalized medicine. They were really trying to tailor to people who are going to be the highest risk for stress ulcers.
Unfortunately, the era of truly personalized medicine is still in the future, which makes me think of the joke that personalized medicine is the future, and it always will be.
Another realistic take on medicine. I love it, Greg. All right, so then the two risk factors that they did identify for clinically important stress ulcer bleeding was, one, respiratory failure, meaning mechanical ventilation, and two, coagulopathy. Then there were some other studies that added two other categories, which is shock, and the last being cirrhosis, increasing clinically important bleeding.
I look at that list of risk factors and I kind of think, duh, sicker patients are sicker.
Again, very, very real there.
Definitely. Okay, so let's pause and recap. Stress ulcers are common in critically ill patients, but under 2% actually have clinically important bleeding, which means hemodynamic compromise or needing a blood transfusion. And the risk factors for bleeding are mechanical ventilation, coagulopathy, shock, and liver disease.
All right, so we know that patients in the ICU often have mucosal erosion, and that sometimes leads to clinically significant bleeding. So it makes sense that a PPI should theoretically work. But let's dive into that theory a bit more. And by diving in, I mean step back and learn what's the story behind stress ulcer prophylaxis and where has the evidence led us?
So the first studies date back to the late 70s. You won't believe it, Shreya, but they gave liquid antacid, so that was a magnesium aluminum solution, and they gave it down the NG tube. And then they would aspirate gastric contents to make sure the pH was above 4.
Wow, I just keep picturing an intern having to be responsible for monitoring gastric pH overnight, and bless.
Yeah,
feel bad.
I know, not a nice job, and it must have been pretty unpleasant for the patients too. But the mortality rate from the stress ulcers in the 1970s exceeded a whopping 80%. So even this really labor-intensive process may have made some sense.
And so it's not surprising that studies showing that patients who were treated with liquid antacids then had subsequently numerically fewer GI bleeds. And I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that so much about the care we provide in the ICU has changed drastically over the past generation. I mean, these studies were done in the late 70s. And so think about today. Ventilator technology is totally different. We feed and mobilize patients much earlier, and we are so much better at recognizing and treating sepsis.
Yeah. And then these days, we're also more aware of the dangers of prolonged steroids, right? That contributes to stress ulcers. Also, we have endoscopy now, and the way we treat acute bleeds is wildly better.
I'm of the mindset that almost every practice in medicine should come with an expiration date before we need to generate new evidence that supports the continued use of any ongoing intervention.
Nice. So let's see if the evidence for antacid holds up or expires as our practice changes.
So then the next wave of trials looked at the H2 antagonists.
And that was in 1998, there was a big trial published in the New England Journal that showed ranitidine given IV was actually better than sucralfate given PO or via an NG at preventing GI bleeds in our ventilated ICU patients. Bleeding rates were 1.7% in the ranitidine arm compared to 3.8% in the sucralfate arm.
Yeah, but acid suppression doesn't come without risks. From these early studies, we started to notice that there may be a higher risk of aspiration pneumonia. The theory was that if you raised the gastric pH too much, the stomach might get colonized by gram-negative bugs, increasing the risk of aspiration pneumonia.
Thankfully, we did have this randomized control trial that looked at actual rates of pneumonia in a more rigorous way.
Yeah. So what this study done in 1998 showed was that there was no difference in rates of pneumonia between the two groups.
Yeah. So some reassurance that giving IV H2 blockers didn't increase pneumonia by, say, increasing gastric pH and facilitating some sort of aspiration pneumonia.
And so the takeaway from that 1998 ranitidine study is that H2 blockers could be used safely and effectively for stress ulcer prevention in high-risk ICU patients.
I just got to say, guys, I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but I didn't know H2 blockers were strong enough to prevent stress ulcers in the ICU. Like, I don't know why I thought of them as like being like the backup player that we'd like call in when, you know, they have some adverse effect of PPI or there's some shortage or something like that.
That's not fair to Pepcid.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
I totally agree with you, Shreya. So it's nice to know that the H2 blockers do work. And actually in 1999, they included them in the first stress ulcer prophylaxis guidelines. And those guidelines said you could use either H2 blockers or sucralfate.
But the strength of that recommendation was graded as level of evidence C, meaning the evidence behind it was really somewhat limited.
Okay, so far we've been talking about H2 blockers and sucralfate, but our current practice is usually to reach for a PPI. So curious, when did PPIs enter the scene?
So there were a few underpowered trials looking at PPIs and stress ulcer bleeding. But because these were small studies, they really didn't add significantly to the evidence base. And guys, can you believe it? It wasn't until 20 years later, in 2018, wow, that we actually started to have stronger evidence to support PPI use.
It's wild to think that all of us who wrote orders for PPIs for intubated patients before 2018 were essentially making our decisions based on the transitive property. We had evidence H2 blockers worked, and so we assume PPIs should work too.
Wild.
But that's making clinical decisions with a lower quality of evidence than we should aspire to use in our practice. We should really strive for more.
Yeah, so it really surprised me that it took until 2018 for the SUP-ICU trial, which was published in NEJM in December 2018 and investigated PPI versus placebo in an ICU setting.
Wait, hold on a sec. Versus placebo? But we literally just talked about how H2 blockers work better compared to sucralfate and were guideline recommended. And so why didn't they compare PPIs to H2 antagonists or even sucralfate? Was that ethical?
That's a really good point, Greg. But remember, while stress ulcer prophylaxis was guideline recommended in 1999, the strength of that recommendation was pretty lukewarm. And by the time this study was done 20 years later, there was a sense in the ICU community that actually ICU care had just improved so much, they had enteral feeding, and that stress ulcer bleeding just wasn't that common and wasn't a major clinical risk anymore.
Yeah, I see. And then I also remember at that time, there was all this buzz of new observational evidence linking PPIs to nosal cholmule infections, to C. diff. I know we talked about aspiration pneumonia. And I know this is all observational evidence, but yeah, there was some concern in the community that PPIs cause harm.
Yeah, it was like you said, Greg, the expiration date had run out for stress ulcer prophylaxis.
Okay. Seems like there was enough clinical equipoise with both the unclear benefits of acid blockade given improvements in ICU care, along with all these possible harms of PPI use. And so it makes sense to do a trial comparing PPI to placebo. And so what did the SUP-ICU trial aim to show?
SUP-ICU wanted to see if PPI prophylaxis would reduce death at 90 days.
All-cause mortality is a super ambitious endpoint for such a rare outcome. And so I give the investigators credit for trying to show a benefit on death from any cause, but there's something odd about that to me. We know stress ulcers are pretty rare, and that means mortality from stress ulcer bleeding, even though it's high, is going to be a pretty uncommon outcome, even for the sickest patients.
Yeah, so that's why SUP-ICU recruited 3,298 patients, which is a really impressive number for an ICU trial. But unsurprisingly, this trial failed to show any difference in mortality at 90 days between PPI and placebo.
Yeah, and then looking at the potential harms of PPIs, SUP-ICU did something a little different. They made a composite endpoint looking at clinically important GI bleeds, which is what I think we really care about, and also all the bad stuff we're worried about, pneumonia, C. diff, myocardial infarction, and grouped all that into one big composite outcome. And what they found was that there was no difference in events between the PPI versus placebo arm.
If you look just at clinically important bleeding, then the data looks way better in support of PPIs. And so clinically important bleeding rates were 2.5% in the PPI arm compared to 4.2% in the placebo arm. But if we just look at that, we have to split up that composite endpoint, which always makes it statistically questionable to interpret the results in that manner.
Yeah. Speaking of which, there was another thing that gave me a bit of a pause, which was looking at the post hoc subgroup analysis. And I know, Greg, you have your soapbox about subgroup analysis, just hypothesis generating. I know. But
thank you for saving me the time.
Yeah. But it was interesting to look at the signal that we saw in a subgroup of people who had the highest illness severity scores.
Just for reference, Shreya, how do ICUs commonly define illness severity? Well, they use illness severity scores, and points are counted for things like low blood pressure, low urine output, the degree of derangement of pH or electrolytes. So when you mean the subgroup of sickest patients here, Shreya, you mean those with the highest severity score points.
Okay, thank you for that context. So yeah, when we did look at the sickest group of people, they actually had an increased mortality when they were treated with a PPI. And that definitely surprised me, right? And again, I know this is a subgroup and there's no clear biological explanation as to why the sickest might be harmed by a PPI compared to the sickest that didn't get a PPI, but just some food for thought to throw out there.
Right. And so it's not anything conclusive that should clearly direct our patient care. But what I will take away from this trial is that PPIs may reduce clinically important bleeding compared to placebo, but they might not be a net positive for all patient groups. And since we already know clinically important bleeding from stress ulcers in the ICUs is pretty rare, I'm not really sure that we learned much to alter our practice.
Again, very real, Greg. Love it. All right. You know, I'm still thinking about H2 blockers, especially since, you know, PPIs have a pretty bad rep in terms of some possible harms. So were there any studies that compared H2 blockers versus PPIs?
Yeah, well, kind of. The PEPTIC study was published in JAMA in 2020, and this was a cluster crossover RCT. So whole ICUs were randomized to either use PPI or H2 antagonists for stress ulcer prophylaxis in all of their ventilated patients for 6 months. And then each unit swapped over to use the other drug for 6 months.
I think that that cluster crossover design is such a cool way of studying a question like this because it lets each ICU act as its own control. The only thing that changes is going to be the intervention drug. It's not going to be the way the ICU cares for ventilation or mobility or early feeding. It's just the drug in question.
Yeah, I agree. It's a really nice design. But the primary outcome for PEPTIC was also mortality at 90 days, which, as we've already discussed, makes the likelihood of seeing a difference pretty small given the low event rate.
Don't tell me there was no difference in 90-day mortality between ICUs when they got a PPI versus when they got an H2 blocker.
You got it, Shreya.
Yeah.
But when they actually looked at clinically important bleeding rates as a secondary endpoint, PPIs looked like they were slightly better at lowering the bleeding rate than the H2 blocker arm, but the difference was only 0.5%.
Okay, maybe a little bit of a win for the PPIs. I was waiting for them to show up a little bit because we use them all the time.
Yeah, but don't get too excited too soon because we have a major problem when looking at the results of the PEPTIC study. Unfortunately, there was a lot of contamination between the clusters. So 20% of the ICUs who should have been using H2 blockers actually just used PPIs instead.
Oh, that is a problem. I guess a crossover rate that high kind of makes the results uninterpretable. I guess with that being said, then what did the PEPTIC study actually show in terms of differences in the harms of PPI versus H2 blocker? Was there any signal there? But then again, I don't know if the results are not as interpretable given the amount of contamination in that crossover.
And so the authors do a per protocol analysis, which is an analysis looking at the drug that people actually got compared to the drug that they were randomized to get, to look at what happened to patients who received H2 blockers or actually received PPIs.
Yeah, but per protocol analysis, I remember learning about that in the Beyond Journal Club that we did on colonoscopies a few months ago and remembering like, okay, we need to be careful when we're looking at results in a per protocol manner because we lose that magic of randomization. And so our ability to infer causality can be limited.
And even with those limitations in inferring causality, a per-protocol analysis can still point to interesting signals for both benefits and for harms.
Yeah, so it is reassuring to know that the per-protocol analysis, there was no difference in rates of C. diff infection or in the length of ICU stay between the two arms.
Ah, another win for PPIs, not giving people more C. diff or a longer length of stay from complications.
Leaving aside that issue with contamination in the crossover and the per-protocol discussion, do you know what's really most concerning to me about the results from the PEPTIC trial?
What's that?
It's that PEPTIC found that same link between illness severity and worse outcomes with PPI that we saw in SUP ICU.
Wait, again? The sickest patients on PPI had a higher mortality?
Yeah, it's really weird because typically I think of medical interventions that have a benefit as actually having the most benefit in the sickest patients. And so there's something fascinating about the possibility that acid suppression for ICU patients actually follows a U-shaped curve where it's all about finding the sweet spot.
Yeah, so bizarre. And now that makes me a little bit more curious what the revised trial did show with that regard. So maybe we can sum up the story thus far, right? We learned from the big ICU trials on acid suppression that there was some old evidence that H2 blockers were better than sucralfate. And then we had a multi-decade gap before SEP-ICU and PEPTIC that suggested that PPIs might reduce clinically important bleeding, but did not save lives for intubated ICU patients.
Exactly. Okay. So that brings us up to date to the revised trial. The revised trial randomized 4,821 ICU patients to receive either IV PPI or placebo. Participants were followed up for 90 days, and there were two outcomes. The primary efficacy outcome was clinically important GI bleeding, and the primary safety outcome was any death.
I'm sure the statisticians were glad to hear that we have bleeding as a primary outcome this time, in addition to the primary safety outcome of 90-day all-cause mortality.
The revised trial recruited patients from 8 countries, from both community hospitals and academic medical centers, so it's a really diverse patient and hospital population.
Yes, and then if we look at the diverse patient population in REVISE, the average age of these patients were about 58 years old, a third of them were women, 3/4 of the patients were medical patients as opposed to surgical or trauma patients, and the most common reason for admission to the ICU was respiratory disease, and most were not on acid suppression before coming to the ICU. And just to paint a picture of how sick these patients were, they're all mechanically ventilated and about 70% of them were on vasopressors or inotropes.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty sick group of patients that you could find in any medical ICU. So these patients were randomized to either 40 milligrams of IV pantoprazole daily or placebo treatment, and they continued that treatment for 90 days or until the patient was no longer intubated.
I'm fascinated that the comparison in this trial was a placebo, but we already went over that argument based on how ICU care has been changing, and that created clinical equipoise about whether acid suppression is truly beneficial in ventilated ICU patients. So Sarah, do you want to do us the honor of telling us what the results showed?
Yeah, good news. So bleeding rates were significantly lower in those treated with a PPI. Bleeding rates were 1% in the PPI arm compared to 3.5% in the placebo arm, giving us a hazard ratio of 0.3 and a p-value of less than 0.001.
You don't need a master's in statistics to know that a p-value of less than 0.001 is statistically significant, and the reduction in clinically significant bleeding from a PPI was very unlikely to be due to chance.
Yeah, and you'll also be relieved to learn that there was no difference in 90-day mortality between the two arms, with mortality rates of 29 and 30%.
Yeah, but then what about some of the other possible like negative consequences of PPIs? Pneumonia, C. diff infections, what do REVISE tell us about this?
So it was pretty reassuring in terms of safety outcomes too. There were no differences in the rates of ventilator-associated pneumonia, which happened in about a quarter of patients in both groups, and no differences in the rates of C. diff infection, which occurred in about 1% of patients in both groups.
Nice. Look at PPI making a comeback after getting such a bad rep on the streets out there back in the day.
Everything in medicine happens in a pendulum.
Yes, yes.
Another nice thing about REVISE that's really quite innovative is that the investigators created a new outcome to define success in terms of things that are really important to our patients, the aptly named patient-important bleeding.
Oh, I love that. Okay, so what did they find when they talked to patients who survived the ICU as being really important to their experience and what mattered to them?
So this patient-defined outcome included if the patient got any transfusion at all. So remember, for the clinically important bleeding outcome, we needed a transfusion of 2 units of blood. It also included needing vasopressor treatment, needing a diagnostic endoscopy, needing a CT scan or surgery, as well as prolonged hospitalization, long-term disability, and death.
Ugh, this is such a good idea to have patient-centered outcome and something I wish a lot more RCTs had. Because like for us, I think, yeah, a click in the EMR, oh, CAT scan is not a biggie for us. But for these patients and families, like the urgent CT scan ride can be pretty stressful. And you know, I remember actually my three-year-old had to get a CT scan and it was probably one of the most traumatic days of my life. And so, again, I'm really glad they included this to Sarah, what did they find about those patient-centered outcomes between the people in ICU that had a PPI versus a placebo?
So PPIs did significantly reduce this patient-important outcome. The rate was 1.5% in the PPI arm and 4.2% in the placebo arm, which equates to about a 60% relative risk reduction in things that patients really care about.
And okay, so to summarize all of that data, we finally have some pretty strong evidence that a daily PPI reduces clinically important GI bleeding and patient-important outcomes in a contemporary ICU population of intubated patients. It is kind of crazy to think it's taken us until 2024 to be really confident that a daily PPI helps our mechanically ventilated patients, but the data from REVISE is really compelling to me.
Yeah, I'm glad we got some data here, despite it being on our ICU checklist, I think, since forever. I guess one last thing to round out our discussion on the REVISE trial is I'm thinking about those patients who are the sickest illness severity, and I'm curious, what did the REVISE trial show in that regard? Did it have a similar pattern to the sub-ICU and the PEPTA trials?
So reassuringly, there was actually no signal in REVISE of increased risk of death in those patients with the highest severity scores.
Ah, plot twist. Okay, but in the good direction.
This is another good lesson about why we shouldn't interpret subgroup analyses as definitive. Yes, there was this signal warning us about PPIs in our sickest patients in the prior trials, but we don't see that signal in REVISE. And so I'll reiterate the point I feel like I'm constantly making. Subgroup analyses are hypothesis generating, but they really shouldn't be practice defining on their own.
I think you've really stressed that point now.
Can't even get mad at you. I love that. It's good.
Okay, before we get carried away, we have another source of information. The REVISE investigators also did a meta-analysis of trials for stress ulcer prophylaxis, which is worth looking at. This was published in the NEJM Evidence Journal in July this year.
Yeah, and that meta-analysis had 12 trials of PPI versus placebo in the ICU, about 9,000 patients. But be warned that 3/4 of the participants in the meta-analysis came from the REVISE and the sub-ICU trials.
And to no one's surprise, this meta-analysis confirms that PPI use reduces the risk of clinically important bleeding by half and nice. Had no effect on mortality.
And the meta-analysis also showed that there was no increase in the risk of pneumonia or C. diff with PPI treatment.
Nice. So I'm glad to see there's no increased risk of pneumonia or C. diff badness across all the studies that we've talked about so far. Again, maybe we can take that bad rap off the table. But I'm curious then about the subgroup analysis with that highest severity illness group. Did the meta-analysis give us any new information about PPIs in the sickest?
So when they stratified by severity in the meta-analysis, there was a suggestion that PPI did reduce the risk of death in those with less severe disease, but it found PPIs may increase mortality in those with more severe disease.
Wait, hold on. No, I thought PPIs were on the winning train here. Kind of feel like I got a whiplash all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's a brain melt. But the fine print caveat is that for those with higher severity scores in the meta-analysis, the confidence interval is crossed 1, so we actually can't be certain whether PPIs were helpful or harmful.
Huh. My take home from the REVISE trial is that we can be pretty confident that PPIs reduce bleeding and improve outcomes that matter to patients who are intubated in the ICU. The elephant in the room for me is that question of why the sickest patients may have the signal for harm. That's totally perplexing. So they don't get more C. diff. They don't have a higher risk of aspiration pneumonia. And so what is the biological explanation of why PPIs might increase the risk of death for the sickest group of ICU patients?
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't think anyone knows right now. All right. So maybe we can round out our discussion with how most internists interface with PPIs, which is thinking about the choice of, do I refill? Do I deprescribe this PPI? What was the actual indication in the first place?
It's such an important question because PPIs are one of those drugs where are really widely prescribed and then they just stay on the med list forever. And so we as doctors really need to be aware of indication creep.
Yeah, I love that. So I think we can now all agree that PPI prophylaxis for stress ulcers in ventilated ICU patients is a good idea. But can we just talk about if these trials can help us with when we should be deprescribing the PPIs?
Yeah, so all of these trials were really short, only 90 days or 3 months, and also were performed in ventilated patients only.
Okay, so then the investigators stopped mandating PPI treatment when the patients were extubated?
Yeah, so we can really consider the indication for the PPI is being intubated, and once the patient is extubated, that indication goes away.
Great. So then it reinforces that those of us getting patients who are getting bumped out of the ICU, we can feel empowered to stop the PPI if there isn't any other good reason for it.
And the guidelines would agree with you. They recommend that critically ill patients with risk factors for stress ulcer formation should receive either PPI or H2 blocker prophylaxis. But they also recommend that those should be discontinued when critical illness is no longer present or when the risk factor is no longer there. And so those risk factors, remember, are ventilated patients, those with coagulopathy, shock, and liver disease. The guidelines also recommend that we discontinue stress ulcer prophylaxis before the patients are transferred out of the ICU.
Okay, so to close out, what about the unknowns or the unanswered questions that we have in the stress ulcer prophylaxis story?
Well, for me, I'm still a bit stressed out by that really big unanswered question about the sickest patients and that harm that we talked about. Sorry, I snuck another one in.
It's good.
For the time being, REVISE is going to be the final word on this topic. So I'm not sure we're ever going to get a clear answer to that really important unanswered question.
Yeah, that's so true, Greg. Like a large trial recruiting the sickest patients in the ICU to investigate the effect of PPI prophylaxis, it's not really going to be ethical or feasible.
I'm going to actually take a more meta conclusion from this trial. We should be demanding a higher quality level of evidence for even our most mundane clinical practices, like the PPIs on our ICU checklist. And so I'm so thankful that the Canadian Critical Care Trial Group was willing to spend the time and money studying the question in REVISE.
Yeah, now that we order PPIs, we can actually do it with a little bit more confidence. There's some data behind it versus like, hey, it's a part of my checklist or I'm getting some EMR nudge for it.
We owe it to our patients to be consistently demanding that the evidence base supporting our decision making is strong. And we should feel comfortable thinking that our clinical practices have an expiration date, especially as the medicine and technology change the clinical context.
And you could argue that the evidence bar should be even higher when we are implementing something automatic in our order sets. If the EMR is going to imply that this is an obvious treatment, then we should be demanding that the data are pretty ironclad.
Yeah. Can you guys imagine like some clinical trial having in their introduction paragraph, the reason why we're doing this is because the data for this practice has reached its expiration date. Like what a like honest, inspiring way to just to rethink our norms and to advance our evidence base that way.
Yeah, and I really hope these new trials will also do the hard work to ask patients about what really matters to them and include patient-important endpoints, which are derived from patients' lived experiences and not just what matter to us as doctors or what the hospital gets dinged on.
Yeah, right. Having a primary endpoint, secondary endpoint, and then the patient-important endpoint too.
So awesome.
That's such a good idea. And that is a wrap for today. If you found this episode helpful, please share with your team and colleagues and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
Thank you to Dr. Jimin Wong for the accompanying graphic and to Jerome Reyes for the audio editing.
If you have any feedback, please email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions.
You won't believe it, Shreya, but they gave liquid antacid. Sorry, start again.
Is that an Irish thing? Antacid?
I don't know.
The tongue.
But these studies were small and But these studies were small, single site. I can't say small, single site studies.
it's overdue. Wait, its expiration date is overdue.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.